And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here again. We've just finished Health Chat with Benta, and there's been a few things coming in from people about that particular talk, and mostly it's, yeah, really, really surprising people that things are still running fairly hot with this new version of COVID. And we certainly hope that the information that was provided is useful to you. There's all sorts of issues around it, as we know. But at any rate, we also have to say a big thank you to our sponsors, and here they are.
The Araluen Valley Hotel offers visitors and locals a welcoming bar with cold beer on tap, a games room and a beer garden. Open 5 days a week, Wednesday to Sunday, with delicious Sunday roasts at lunch and dinner. Bistro meals serve from 12 to 2pm and 6 to 8pm. Strictly observing COVID guidelines, every visitor is required to register on entry by digital sign-on. Araluen Valley Hotel. Find us on Facebook or phone 4846 4023. Supporting our local radio station, Braidwood FM 88.9.
Specialising in rural conveyancing and succession planning, Chamberlain's Law Firm are with you for all your legal needs. No matter how big or small, their lawyers can assist with a range of legal problems and advice. With offices in Braidwood, Canberra and Sydney, they have team members everywhere to assist you. Call Chamberlain's today on 6188 6200 or find them online at chamberlains.com.au to speak with their expert lawyers about your legal needs. Chamberlain's Law Firm, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Where should you go to see the future of farming? It's as close as White's Tractor Kubota dealer right now. The next generation of tractor has arrived, the remarkable M71 range. At the heart of Kubota's most powerful tractor ever is a 6.1-litre engine that delivers 170 horsepower of dynamic, clean efficiency like never before. At every level, the M71 has the technology that professional farming demands for success. Arrange a test drive at White's Tractor's new premises at 50 Robinson Street, Goulburn, and experience a new high-spec powerhouse from Kubota. White's Tractor's is happy to support Braidwood FM.
Braidwood FM sponsor Braidwood Air Conditioning is your local air conditioning specialist for the installation and servicing of commercial and residential premises. Ryan is licensed and insured and has been in the industry for over 12 years. You can contact Ryan on 0405 274 227 or email him at info@braidwoodairconditioning.com.au or visit the website braidwoodairconditioning.com.au.
Braidwood's Half Cut Barber is now open at the Braidwood Hotel, offering traditional grooming services for the men of Braidwood. Open Tuesday to Friday, 12 noon to 6pm, and Saturday, 9am to 12 noon. Walk-ins are welcome. Contact Braidwood's Half Cut Barber through their webpage. Proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you, as always, to our sponsors. They help us to keep our little radio station going, and we've been reading Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott, and, well, we have some interesting things going on. John is terrified of Richard coming back. The Black Knight, Sir Sluggard, is currently having a good time with Friar Tuck, and, well, Cedric and Athelstane, what's going to be happening there. Continuing on. Meanwhile, Cedric and Athelstane, the leaders of the troop, conversed together on the state of the land, on the dissensions of the royal family, on the feuds and quarrels among the Norman nobles, and on the chance with which there was that the oppressed Saxons might be able to free themselves from the yoke of the Normans, or at least to elevate themselves into national consequence and independence during the civil convulsions which were likely to ensue. On this subject, Cedric was all animation. The restoration of the independence of his race was the idol of his heart, to which he had willingly sacrificed domestic happiness and the interests of his son. But in order to achieve this great revolution in favour of the native English, it was necessary that they should be united among themselves and act under an acknowledged head. The necessity of choosing their chief from Saxon blood royal was not only evident in itself, but had been made a solemn condition by those whom Cedric had entrusted with his secret plans and hopes. Athelstane had this quality at least, and though he had few mental accomplishments or talents to recommend him as a leader, he had still a goodly person, was no coward, had been accustomed to martial exercises, and seemed willing to defer to the advice of counsellors more wise than he himself. Above all, he was known to be liberal and hospitable, and believed to be good-natured. But whatever pretensions Athelstane had to be considered as head of the Saxon Confederacy, many of that nation were disposed to prefer to his the title of the Lady Rowena, who drew her descent from Alfred, and whose father, having been a chief renowned for wisdom and courage and generosity, his memory was highly honoured by his oppressed subjects. It would have been no difficult thing for Cedric, had he been so disposed, to have placed himself at the head of a third party, as formidable at least as any of the others. To counterbalance their royal descent, he had courage, activity, energy, and above all, that devoted attachment to the cause which had procured him the epithet of the Saxon, and his birth was inferior to none, excepting only that of Athelstane and his ward. These qualities, however, were unalloyed by the slightest shade of selfishness. Instead of dividing yet farther his weakening nation by forming a faction of his own, it was a leading part of Cedric's plan to extinguish that which already existed by promoting a marriage betwixt Rowena and Athelstane. An obstacle occurred to this, his favourite project, in the mutual attachment of his ward and his son, and hence the original cause of the banishment of Wilfred from the house of his father. This stern measure Cedric had adopted in hopes that during Wilfred's absence, Rowena might relinquish her preference, but in this hope he was disappointed, a disappointment which might be attributed in part to the mode in which his ward had been educated. Cedric, to whom the name of Alfred was as that of a deity, had treated the sole remaining scion of that great monarch with a degree of observance such as perhaps was in those days scarce paid to an acknowledged princess. Rowena's will had been in almost all cases a law to his household, and Cedric himself, as if determined that her sovereignty should be fully acknowledged within that little circle at least, seemed to take a pride in acting as the first of her subjects. Thus trained in the exercise not only of free will, but despotic authority, Rowena was, by her previous education, disposed both to resist and to resent any attempt to control her affections, or dispose of her hand contrary to her inclinations, and to assert her independence in a case in which even those females who have been trained up to obedience and subjection are not infrequently apt to dispute the authority of guardians and parents. The opinions which she felt strongly, she avowed boldly, and Cedric, who could not free himself from his habitual deference to her opinions, felt totally at a loss as to how to enforce his authority of guardian. It was in vain that he attempted to dazzle her with the prospect of a visionary throne. Rowena, who possessed strong sense, neither considered his plan as practicable nor as desirable, so far as she was concerned, could it have been achieved. Without attempting to conceal her avowed preference of Wilfred of Ivanhoe, she declared that, were that favoured knight out of question, she would rather take refuge in a convent than share a throne with Athelstane, whom, having always despised, she now began, on account of the trouble she received on his account, thoroughly to detest. Nevertheless, Cedric, whose opinion of women's constancy was far from strong, persisted in using every means in his power to bring about the proposed match, in which he conceived he was rendering an important service to the Saxon cause. The sudden and romantic appearance of his son in the lists at Ashby he had justly regarded as almost a death's blow to his hopes. His paternal affection, it is true, had for an instant gained the victory over pride and patriotism, but both had returned in full force, and under their joint operation he was now bent upon making a determined effort for the union of Athelstane and Rowena, together with expediting those other measures which seemed necessary to forward the restoration of Saxon independence. On this last subject, he was now labouring with Athelstane, not without having reason every now and then to lament, like Hotspur, that he should have moved such a dish of skim milk to so honourable an action. Athelstane, it is true, was vain enough, and loved to have his ears tickled with tales of his high descent and of his right by inheritance to homage and sovereignty. But his petty vanity was sufficiently gratified by receiving this homage at the hands of his immediate attendants and of the Saxons who approached him. If he had the courage to encounter danger, he at least hated the trouble of going to seek it. And while he agreed in general principles laid down by Cedric concerning the claim of the Saxons to independence, and was still more easily convinced of his own title to reign over them when that independence should be attained, yet when the means of asserting these rights came to be discussed, he was still Athelstane the Unready, slow, irresolute, procrastinating, and unenterprising. The warm and impassioned exhortations of Cedric had as little effect upon his impassive temper as red-hot balls alighting in the water, which produced a little sound and smoke and are instantly extinguished. If, leaving this task, which might be compared to spurring a tired jade or to hammering upon cold iron, Cedric fell back to his ward Rowena, and he received little more satisfaction from conferring with her. For, as his presence interrupted the discourse between the lady and her favourite attendant upon the gallantry and fate of Wilfred, Elgitha failed not to revenge both her mistress and herself by recurring to the overthrow of Athelstane in the lists, the most disagreeable subject which could greet the ears of Cedric. To this sturdy Saxon, therefore, the day's journey was fraught with all manner of displeasure and discomfort, so that he more than once internally cursed the tournament, and him who had proclaimed it, together with his own folly in ever thinking of going. At noon, upon the motion of Athelstane, the travellers paused in a woodland shade by a fountain to repose their horses and partake of some provisions, with which the hospitable abbot had loaded a sumpter mule. Their repast was a pretty long one, and these several interruptions rendered it impossible for them to hope to reach Rotherwood without travelling all night, a conviction which induced them to proceed on their way at a more hasty pace than they had hitherto used. Chapter 19. The travellers had now reached the verge of the wooded country, and were about to plunge into its recesses, held dangerous at that time from the number of outlaws whom oppression and poverty had driven to despair, and who occupied the forests in such large bands as could easily bid defiance to the feeble police of the period. For these rovers, however, notwithstanding the lateness of the hour, Cedric and Athelstane accounted themselves secure, as they had in attendance 10 servants, besides Womba and Garth, whose aid could not be counted upon, the one being a jester and the other a captive. It may be added that in travelling thus late through the forest, Cedric and Athelstane relied on their descent and character as well as their courage. The outlaws whom the severity of the forest laws had reduced to this roving and desperate mode of life were chiefly peasants and yeomen of Saxon descent, and were generally supposed to respect the persons and property of their countrymen. As the travellers journeyed on their way, they were alarmed by repeated cries for assistance, and when they rode up to the place from whence they came, they were surprised to find a horse litter placed upon the ground, beside which sat a young woman, richly dressed in the Jewish fashion, while an old man whose yellow cap proclaimed him to belong to the same nation walked up and down with gestures of deepest despair, and wrung his hands as if affected by some strange disaster. To the inquiries of Athelstane and Cedric, the old Jew could for some time answer by invoking the protection of all the patriarchs of the Old Testament successively against the sons of Ishmael, who were coming to smite them hip and thigh with the edge of the sword. When he began to come to himself out of this agony of terror, Isaac of York, for it was our old friend, was at length able to explain that he had hired a bodyguard of 6 men at Ashby, together with mules for carrying the litter of a sick friend. This party had undertaken to escort him as far as Doncaster. They had come thus far in safety, but having received information from a woodcutter that there was a strong band of outlaws lying in wait in the woods before them, Isaac's mercenaries had not only taken flight, but had carried off with them the horses which bore the litter, and left the Jew and his daughter without the means either of defence or of retreat, to be plundered and probably murdered by the bandits whom they expected every moment would bring down upon them. "Would it but please your valours," added Isaac in a tone of deep humiliation, to permit the poor Jews to travel under your safeguard. I swear by the tables of our law that never has favour been conferred upon a child of Israel since the days of our captivity, which shall be more gratefully acknowledged.
Dog of a Jew,
said Athelstane, whose memory was of that petty kind, which stores up trifles of all kinds, but particularly trifling offences. Do you not remember how you did beard us in the gallery at the tilt-yard? Fight or flee or compound with the outlaws as you wish. Ask neither aid nor company from us. And if they rob only such as you, who rob all the world, I for mine share shall hold them right honest folk. Cedric did not assent to the severe proposal of his companion.
We shall do better, said he, to leave them two of our attendants and two horses, to convey them back to the next village. It will diminish our strength but little, and with your good sword, noble Athelstane, and the aid of those who remain, it will be light work for us to face 20 of those renegades.
Rowena, somewhat alarmed by the mention of the outlaws in force and near them, strongly seconded the proposal of her guardian. But Rebecca, suddenly quitting her dejected posture and making her way through the attendants to the palfrey of the Saxon lady, knelt down and, after the Oriental fashion in addressing superiors, kissed the hem of Rowena's garment. Then, rising and throwing back her veil, she implored her, in the great name of the God whom they both worshipped, and by that revelation of the law upon Mount Sinai, in which they both believed, that she would have compassion upon them, and suffer them to go forward under their safeguard. "It is not for myself that I pray this favour," said Rebecca, "nor is it even for that poor old man. I know that to wrong and to spoil our nation is a light fault, if not a merit, with Christians. And what is it to us whether it be done in the city, in the desert, or in the field? But it is in the name of one dear to many, and dear even to you, that I beseech you to let this sick person be transported with care and tenderness under your protection. For if evil chance him, the last moment of your life would be embittered with regret for denying that which I ask of you." The noble and solemn air which Rebecca made this appeal gave it double weight for the fair Saxon. "The man is old and feeble," she said to her guardian, "the maiden young and beautiful, their friend sick and in peril of his life. Jews though they be, we cannot, as Christians, leave them in this extremity. Let them unload two of the sumpter mules and put the baggage behind two of the serfs. The mules may transport the litter, and we have led horses for the old man and his daughter." Cedric readily assented to what she proposed, and Athelstane only added the condition that they should travel in the rear of the whole party, where Wamba, he said, might attend them with his shield of boar's brawn.
"I have left my shield in the tilt-yard," answered the jester, "as has been the fate of many a better knight than myself."
Athelstane coloured deeply, for such had been his own fate on the last day of the tournament, while Rowena, who was pleased in the same proportion, as if to make amends for the brutal jest of her unfeeling suitor, requested Rebecca to ride by her side.
"It were not fit that I should do so," answered Rebecca, with proud humility, "where my society might be held a disgrace to my protectress."
By this time, the change of baggage was hastily achieved, for the single word "outlaws" rendered everyone sufficiently alert, and the approach of twilight made the sound yet more impressive. Amid the bustle, Garth was taken from horseback, in the course of which removal he prevailed upon the jester to slack the cord with which his arms were bound. It was so negligently refastened, perhaps intentionally, on the part of Wamba, that Garth found no difficulty in freeing his arms altogether from bondage, and then gliding into the thicket, he made his escape from the party. The bustle had been considerable, and it was some time before Garth was missed. For, as he was to be placed for the rest of the journey behind a servant, everyone supposed that some other of his companions had him under his custody, and when it began to be whispered among them that Garth had actually disappeared, they were under such immediate expectation of an attack from the outlaws that it was not at all convenient to pay much attention to the circumstance. The path upon which the party travelled was now so narrow as not to admit with any sort of convenience above two riders abreast,
and began to descend into a dingle traversed by a brook whose banks were broken, swampy, and overgrown with dwarf willows. Cedric and Athelstane, who were at the head of their retinue, saw the risk of being attacked at this pass, but neither of them having had much practice in war, no better mode of preventing the danger occurred to them than that they should hasten through the defile as fast as possible. Advancing, therefore, without much order, they had just crossed the brook with a part of their followers when they were assailed in front, flank, and rear at once, with an impetuosity to which, in their confused and ill-prepared condition, it was impossible to offer effectual resistance. The shout of, "A white dragon! A white dragon! St. George for Merry England!" war cries adopted by the assailants as belonging to their assumed character of Saxon outlaws, was heard on every side, and on every side enemies appeared with a rapidity of advance and attack which seemed to multiply their numbers. Both the Saxon chiefs were made prisoner at the same moment, and each under circumstances expressive of his character. Cedric, the instant an enemy had appeared, launched at him his remaining javelin, which, taking better effect than that which he had hurled at Fangs, nailed the man against the oak tree that happened to be close behind him. Thus far successful, Cedric spurred his horse against a second, drawing his sword at the same time, and striking with such inconsiderate fury that his weapon encountered a thick branch which hung over him, and he was disarmed by the violence of his own blow. He was instantly made prisoner, and pulled from his horse by two or three of the bandits who crowded round him. Athelstane shared his captivity, his bridle having been seized, and he himself forcibly dismounted, long before he could draw his weapon or assume any posture of actual defence. The attendants, embarrassed with baggage, surprised, and terrified at the fate of their master, fell an easy prey to the assailants, while the Lady Rowena, in the centre of the cavalcade, and the Jew and his daughter in the rear, experienced the same misfortune. Of all the train, none escaped, except Wamba, who showed upon the occasion much more courage than those who pretended to greater sense. He possessed himself of a sword belonging to one of the domestics, who was just drawing it with a tardy and irresolute hand, laid it about him like a lion, drove back several who approached him, and made a brave though ineffectual attempt to succour his master. Finding himself overpowered, the jester at length threw himself from his horse, plunged into the thicket, and, favoured by the general confusion, escaped from the scene of action. Yet the valiant jester, as soon as he found himself safe, hesitated more than once whether he should not turn back and share the captivity of a master to whom he was sincerely attached. "I have heard men talk of the blessings of freedom," he said to himself, "but I wish any wise man would teach me what use to make of it, now that I actually have it." As he pronounced these words, a loud voice, very near him, called out in a low and cautious tone, "Wamba!" And at the same time a dog, which he recognised to be Fangs, jumped up and fawned upon him. "Garth?" answered Wamba, with the same caution, and the swineherd immediately stood before him. "What is the matter?" said he eagerly. "What mean these cries and that clashing of swords?" "Only a trick of the times," said Wamba. "They are all prisoners." "Who are prisoners?" exclaimed Garth impatiently. "My lord and my lady, and Athelstane, and Hunderbert, and Oswald." "In the name of God," said Garth, "how come they prisoners, and to whom?" "Our master was too ready to fight," said the jester, "and Athelstane was not ready enough, and no other person was ready at all. And they are prisoners to green cassocks and black visors, and they lie all tumbled about on the green like the crab apples that you shake down for your swine. And I would laugh at it," said the honest jester, "if I could for weeping." And he shed tears of unfeigned sorrow. Garth's countenance kindled. "Wamba," he said, "you have a weapon, and your heart was ever stronger than your brain. We are only two, but a sudden attack from men of resolution will do much. Follow me."
"Whither, and for what purpose?" said the jester.
"To rescue Cedric."
"But you have renounced his service but now," said Wamba.
"That," said Garth, "was but while he was fortunate. Follow me."
As the jester was about to obey, a third person suddenly made his appearance and commanded them both to halt. From his dress and arms, Wamba would have conjectured him to be one of those outlaws who had just assailed his master. But besides that, he wore no mask,
and the glittering baldric across his shoulder, with the rich bugle horn which it supported, as well as the calm and commanding expression of his voice, and the manner made him, notwithstanding the twilight, recognise Locksley, the yeoman, who had been victorious under such disadvantageous circumstances at the contest for the prize of archery. "What is the meaning of all this?" said he. "Or who is it that rifle and ransom and make prisoners in the forests?" "Oh, you may look at their cassocks close by," said Wamba, "and see whether they be thy children's coats or no, for they are as like thine own as one green pea cod is to another."
"I will learn that presently," answered Locksley, "and I charge ye on peril of your lives not to stir from the place where you stand until I have returned. Obey me, and it shall be the better for you and your masters. Yet stay, I must render myself as like these men as possible." So saying, he unbuckled his baldric with the bugle, took a feather from his cap, and gave them to Wamba, then drew a vizard from his pouch, and repeating his charges to them to stand fast, he went to execute his purposes of reconnoitring.
"Shall we stand fast, Garth?" said Wamba, "or shall we e'en give him leg bail? In my foolish mind he had all the quippage of a thief, too much in readiness to be himself a true man."
"Let him be the devil," said Garth, "and he will. We can be no worse of waiting his return. If he belonged to that party, he must already have given them the alarm, and it will avail nothing either to fight or to fly. Besides, I have late experience that arrant thieves are not the worst men in the world to have to deal with."
The yeoman returned in the course of a few minutes.
"Friend Garth," he said, "I have mingled among yon men, and have learned to whom they belong, and where they are bound. There is, I think, no chance that they will proceed to any real violence against the prisoners. For three men to attempt them at this moment were little else than madness, for they are good men of war, and have, as such, placed sentinels to give the alarm when anyone approaches. But I trust soon to gather such a force as may act in defiance of all their precautions. You are both servants, and, as I think, faithful servants of Cedric the Saxon, the friend of the rights of Englishmen. He shall not want English hands to help him in this extremity. Come then with me, until I gather more aid." So saying, he walked through the wood at a great pace, followed by the jester and the swineherd. It was not consistent with Wamba's humour to travel long in silence.
"I think," said he, looking at the baldric and bugle, which he still carried, "that I saw the arrow shot which won this gay prize, and that not so long since as Christmas."
"And I," said Garth, "could take it on my halidome that I have heard the voice of the good yeoman who won it, by night as well as by day, and that the moon is not 3 days older since I did so."
"My honest friends," replied the yeoman, "who or what I am is little to the present purpose. Should I free your master, you will have reason to think me the best friend you have ever had in your lives. And whether I am known by one name or another, or whether I can draw a bow as well or better than a cowkeeper, or whether it is my pleasure to walk in sunshine or by moonlight, are matters which, as they do not concern you, so neither need you busy yourselves respecting them."
"Our heads are in the lion's mouth," said Wamba in a whisper to Garth. "Get them out how we can."
"Hush, be silent," said Garth. "Offend him not by your folly, and I trust sincerely that all will go well."
Chapter 20. It was after 3 hours' good walking that the servants of Cedric with their mysterious guide arrived at a small opening in the forest, in the centre of which grew an oak tree of enormous magnitude, throwing its twisted branches in every direction. Beneath this tree 4 or 5 yeomen lay stretched on the ground, while another, a sentinel, walked to and fro in the moonlight shade. Upon hearing the sound of feet approaching, the watch instantly gave the alarm, and the sleepers as suddenly started up and bent their bows. 6 arrows placed on the string were pointed towards the quarter from which the travellers approached, when their guides, being recognised, was welcome with every token of respect and attachment, and all signs and fears of a rough reception was at once subsided.
"Where is the miller?" was his first question.
"On the road towards Rotherham."
"With how many?" demanded the leader, for such he seemed to be.
"With 6 men and good hope of booty, if it please St. Nicholas." devoutly spoken, said Locksley. And where is Alan a Dale?
Walked up towards the Watling Street to watch for the Prior of Jorvaulx.
That is well thought on also, replied the captain. And where is the friar?
In his cell.
There I will go, said Locksley. Disperse and seek your companions. Collect what force you can, for there's game afoot that must be hunted hard, and will turn to bay. Meet me here at daybreak, and stay, he added. I have forgotten what is most necessary of the whole. Two of you take the road quickly towards Torquilstone, the castle of Font de Bouffe. A set of gallants who have been masquerading in such guise as our own are carrying a band of prisoners there. Watch them closely, for even if they reach the castle before we collect our force, our honour is concerned to punish them, and we will find means to do so. Keep a close watch on them, therefore, and dispatch one of your comrades, the lightest of foot, to bring the news of the yeomen thereabout. They promised implicit obedience and departed with alacrity on their different errands. In the meanwhile, their leader and his two companions, who now looked upon him with great respect, as well as some fear, pursued their way to the chapel of Copmanhurst. When they reached the little moonlight glade, having in front the reverend, though ruinous, chapel and the rude hermitage, so well suited to ascetic devotion, Wamba whispered to Garth, "If this be the habitation of a thief, it makes good the old proverb, the nearer the church, the farther from God, and by my coxcomb," he added, "I think it be even so. Hearken but the black sanctus that they are singing in the hermitage." In fact, the anchorite and his guest were performing at the full extent of their very powerful lungs an old drinking song, of which this was the burden. "Come trow the brown bowl to me, bully boy, bully boy. Come troll the brown bowl to me. Ho, jolly Jenkin, I spy a knave in drinking. Come troll the brown bowl to me."
"Now that is not ill sung," said Wamba, who had thrown in a few of his own flourishes to help out the chorus. "But who in the saint's name ever expected to have heard such a jolly chant come out of a hermit's cell and at midnight?"
"Well, that I should," said Garth, "for the jolly clerk of Copmanhurst is a known man and kills half the deer that are stolen in this walk. Men say that the keeper has complained to his official and that he will be stripped of his cowl and cope altogether if he keep not better order." While they were thus speaking, Locksley's loud and repeated knocks had at length disturbed the anchorite and his guest. "By my beads," said the hermit, stopping short in a grand flourish, "here come more benighted guests. I would not for my cowl that they found us in this goodly exercise. All men have their enemies, good Sir Sluggard, and there be those malignant enough to construe the hospitable refreshment which I've been offering you, a weary traveller, for the matter of 3 short hours, into sheer drunkenness and debauchery, vices alike alien to my profession and my disposition."
"Base calumniators," replied the knight, "I would I had been chastising. I would like to chastise them. Nevertheless, holy clerk, it is true that all have their enemies, and there be those in this very land whom I would rather speak to through the bars of my helmet than barefaced."
"Well, get your iron pot on your head then, friend Sluggard, as quickly as nature will permit," said the hermit, "while I remove these pewter flagons, whose late contents run strangely in mine own pate, and to drown the clatter, for in faith I feel somewhat unsteady, strike into the tune which you hear me sing. It is no matter for the words, I scarce know them myself." So saying, he struck up a thundering De Profundis Clamavi, under cover of which he removed the apparatus of their banquet, while the knight, laughing heartily and arming himself all the while, assisted his host with his voice from time to time, as his mirth permitted.
"What in the devil's matins are you after at this hour?" said a voice from without.
"Oh, heaven forgive you, Sir Traveller," said the hermit, whose own noise and perhaps his nocturnal potations prevented from recognising accents which were tolerably familiar to him.
"Mad priest," answered a voice from without, "open to Locksley."
"All safe, all's right," said the hermit to his companion.
"But who is he?" said the Black Knight. "It imports me much to know."
"Who is he?" answered the hermit. "I tell thee, he is a friend."
"But what friend?" answered the knight, "for he may be friend to you, and none of mine."
"What friend?" replied the hermit. "That now is one of the questions that is more easily asked than answered. What friend? Why, he is, now that I bethink me a little, the very same honest keeper I told you of a while since."
"Aye, as honest a keeper as you are to pious hermit," replied the knight, "I doubt it not, but undo the door to him before he beat it from its hinges."
The dogs, in the meantime, which had made a dreadful baying at the commencement of the disturbance, seemed now to recognise the voice of him who stood without, for totally changing their manner, they scratched and whined at the door, as if interceding for his admission. The hermit speedily unbolted his portal and admitted Locksley with his two companions.
"Why, hermit," was the yeoman's first question, as soon as he beheld the knight, "what boon companion have you there?" "A brother of our order," replied the friar, shaking his head. "We have been at our orisons all night."
"He is a monk of the church militant, I think," answered Locksley, "and there be more of them abroad, I tell you, friar, than you must lay down the rosary and take up the quarterstaff. We shall need every one of our merry men, whether clerk or layman, but," he added, taking him a step aside, "are you mad to give admittance to a knight you do not know? Have you forgot our articles?"
"Not know him," replied the friar boldly. "I know him as well as the beggar knows his dish."
"And what is his name, then?" demanded Locksley.
"His name," said the hermit, "his name is Sir Anthony of Scrabblestone. As if I would drink with a man and did not know his name."
"You have been drinking more than enough, friar," said the woodsman, "and I fear prating more than enough too."
"Good yeoman," said the knight, coming forward, "be not wroth with my merry host. He did but afford me the hospitality which I would have compelled from him if he had refused it."
"Thou compel?" said the friar. "Wait but till I have changed this grey gown for a green cassock, and if I make not a quarterstaff ring 12 upon your head, I am neither true clerk nor good woodsman."
While he spoke thus, he stripped off his gown and appeared in a close black buckram doublet and drawers, over which he speedily did on a cassock of green and hose of the same colour.
"I pray thee, trust my points," said he to Wamba, "and you shall have a cup of sack for thy labour."
"Oh, gramercy for thy sack," said Wamba, "but thinkst thou it is lawful for me to aid you transmute yourself from a holy hermit into a sinful forester?"
"Never fear," said the hermit. "I but confess the sins of my green cloak to my grey friar's cloak. All shall be well again."
"Amen," answered the jester. "A broadcloth penitent should have a sackcloth confessor, and your frock may absolve my motley doublet into the bargain." So saying, he accommodated the friar with his assistance in tying the endless number of points, as the laces which attached the hose to the doublet were then termed. While they were thus employed, Locksley led the knight to a little apart and addressed him thus. "Deny it not, Sir Knight. You are he who decided the victory to the advantage of the English against the strangers on the second day of the tournament at Ashby."
"And what follows, if you guess truly, good yeoman?" replied the knight.
"I should in that case hold you," replied the yeoman, "a friend to the weaker party."
"Such is the duty of a true knight, at least," replied the black champion, "and I would not willingly that there were reason to think otherwise of me. But for my purpose," said the yeoman, "you should be as well a good Englishman as a good knight, for that which I have to speak of concerns indeed the duty of every honest man, but is more especially that of a true-born native of England."
"You can speak to no one," replied the knight, "to whom England and the life of every Englishman can be dearer than to me."
Well, that's our book reading for this week. Next Monday, we'll continue on with Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott. Till then, keep well, Braidwood. Keep safe.
You can contact Ryan on 0405 274 227 or email him at info@braidwoodairconditioning.com